Blog Talk Radio.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time. As in, spaghetti sandwiches for dinner? They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keys. Also check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. You can also email me. I'm SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. You guys, you're sleeping on the giveaways. There's a lot of giveaways. Somebody just won a $20 Maggiano gift card the other day. Definitely follow so you have an opportunity to win something. I'm giving away something usually every week, so don't sleep on it, okay? Also, you can listen to the show on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. Well, this morning, I am honored to speak with somebody who's from my hometown. She's American-born. She takes on the borderlands, creating an ongoing dialogue around the places where cultures, races, and imaginations intersect. Her subject matter often draws on her childhood in a middle-class Black family whose children pioneered into white spaces, and on her adult life as a world traveler. We're going to be speaking about her book today called The Red Island House, but she also has some other books that were written and a memoir. Russian Journal was a memoir she wrote and was nominated for a National Book Award. She has a novel called Sarah Phillips, a short story collection, Interesting Women, and the novel Lost Hearts in Italy. Good morning, Andrea Lee.
Good morning. Good morning, Joy. I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh, I should say ciao, ciao.
ciao, buongiorno dall'Italia.
Buongiorno. But is it buonanotte now? Is it not nighttime now for you?
No, it's like dinner time. It's about 5 in the afternoon. We only have like 6 hours difference, thank goodness.
So I said bon notte, but how would you say that, like, dinner time, like, you know,
buonasera.
Buonasera.
I would say good evening. Buonasera è l'ora di cena. That means it's dinner time. l'ora di cena.
look at there. You are so multifaceted. It's funny because myself, I almost became an expat. I would have been living in Germany at one time. That's a whole other story. Or Poland, and that's another story too. But we both have the love of traveling. Where is your favorite place other than Italy? Where is a favorite place to travel?
Ooh, well, I did write this book about Madagascar. Madagascar is one
mm-hmm.
of my favorite places, but it's it is probably the most beautiful country I have. You know, just it's a smallish compared to America. It's a very large island, and it is one of the most beautiful places in the world. So I guess that would be one of my favorite places to be.
So tell the audience a little bit about your book. What is your book about?
Okay, my book is about, it's a collection, it's a novel in the form of vignettes about really what happens when people think they have found paradise, that tropical
mm-hmm.
paradise, which is Madagascar. It kind of stars the country of Madagascar, which is this huge island off the east coast of Africa, a part of Africa formerly, but an island in itself, and it's kind of a unique place. In terms of its nature, in terms of the 19 different ethnicities who are kind of a mixture of I wouldn't say ancient, but Indonesian and African peoples. It's
mm-hmm.
really a unique place. So my book is a series of stories that turn into one big story about a place. It's an imaginary island in Madagascar where a Black American woman and her Italian husband go and build a great big vacation house, as some people have done in Madagascar, on a beach, because it's easy to do because it's kind of a very poor country, so it doesn't cost so much. And over the years, the things that the wife, who's obviously partly my observing eye, sees and encounters during her visits, her long visits to this house on this island in this country, which is from her you know, ancestral continent, which is so foreign to her. And so she sees, you know, she sees the beauty of the country, but she also sees how when foreigners come to the country, they encounter all kinds of pitfalls. There's sex tourism. There's all kinds of things happening to people which do not fit into the idea of paradise, of earthly paradise. So the stories are all starring different people, but all observed by this woman, Shay. And it kind of goes over some years of her life. She goes there as a very young married woman, and doesn't quite know how to face a country that is an African country, which is so alien to her. And then gradually she begins to develop a respectful relationship with it, as she watches a lot of the foreigners who come who do not respect the country.
Mm-hmm,
and so it's
mm-hmm.
It's basically her growing up through her encounter with this country and learning how to respect it, learning how you do face a country that's not yours but you don't want to exploit.
Now, the interesting thing is, one of the things you talk mm-hmm. about in the book, her character, is that, you know, she is African-American, so she would be considered Black, an extension of African, yet she is not of Madagascar and the people. She does not connect fully 100% with them. Only one character, Bertine, she seems to connect with. You, as an expat, you're in Italy, which is a predominantly, or was when I was there, homogenous white culture. How did you connect with the Italians? How did you make yourself comfortable or get comfortable being an expat in Italy?
That's a really interesting question. Am I comfortable? I guess.
That's your present day.
I continue to have you know, it's interesting. I think it's just a question of time. And I raised a family here, but I've never stopped feeling that I'm an American, that I am a foreigner. I speak, you know, very good fluent Italian. I have two children who are bilingual. But we, and I say we meaning my children, also my husband, but he's Italian, remain very, very close and linked to, you know, to what I think of as my homeland, America. Philadelphia in particular. So how did I don't know. I think raising a family, coming to understand that you will never be Italian. I mm-hmm. think when I relax and realize that I may speak the language, but I will always be a Black minister's daughter from Philadelphia. I'm proud of it. I also kind of know what, I don't know, I know, you know, kind of what is at the basis of things in a country once you've lived and been in a family here. So you know, I don't know, about family ties, the powerful family ties in Italy, the, you know, relationship with mothers, with parents, incredible power of tradition here. Once you begin to understand kind of what makes a country kind of go underneath everything, I think you begin to relax and be there. I mean, certainly I've experienced some ignorance and racism, but I think you experience that everywhere, honestly. I think Italy is one of the more relaxed places. I'm not saying that racism does not exist, because it definitely does. And it's become more stressful now for people of color in the country because of economic problems, because there have been more and more immigrants who've come from Africa and other places and you know, and need jobs and are, you know, and are becoming the new face of Italy. Italy is no mm-hmm. longer such a white country. And actually, one of yes. the biggest stars in Italy, the TikTok star, his name is escaping me now, it's so embarrassing, my son would be annoyed with me, but is an African immigrant who has like 30 million TikTok followers, and it's just hilariously funny. We'll have to look up his name at the end of the broadcast. Yeah, he's from Kivasso, no. and but he's African, and he's astonishing. So, I mean, you know, Italy's changed. Let me just look up his name eventually, and I'll tell you.
Okay, we'll look up the name. We can,
go on.
You can tweet it at me,
yeah.
or send it to me through Instagram.
I will,
and
yeah.
One of the things is the role of women in the book. And at first, it appears that the women don't have power, and it's like this patriarchal situation. But then as you get to read the book, and one particular character in particular, what's her name, Noelina, am I saying that correctly? She has the two men fighting over her.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that was the thing that came
out. So at first you think it's just sex. You know, she's using him and she's using her sex. But then later you realize it seems like maybe she had some idea about what she was doing in the long run. Do you feel the role of women in the world has changed much? Are women still using sex in other places to get the things they need? Or are they respected for other parts of their body?
That's a huge question. We could sit here all afternoon and talk about it. I don't know. I think sex is still a fallback plan for a lot of people, not because they have nothing else. For a lot of young women in very poor countries, and I've seen it in Madagascar too, sex is something, unfortunately, that always that is a way of getting ahead. And you can't really judge them. You know, I think Shay realizes, my character realizes in the book early on, that if she were in the same position of these young women who are living in one of the poorest countries in the world, she would probably be doing the same thing. She would probably, you know, she would have very, very little alternative, you know, to work at a miserably paying job or to perhaps make more money, doing sex work. And that is what I have seen. So I don't know. I think there are more opportunities. There's certainly more awareness of the dilemma of young women I see it in Italy here too. There's a lot of prostitution, a lot of sex work here with women from countries outside of Italy who are earning a pittance.
Do you think it should be made legal? You do. And why do you feel that?
Well, because I've spent a lot of time, my daughter actually lives in Amsterdam, and so I've spent a lot of time up there. Actually, I edited Red Island House in Amsterdam, where it is legal, and it's very much, a business protected, I see that it's, you know, sex work is always going to be happening. There's no getting around it. That's human nature. Mm-hmm. And so the women whom I've seen in Amsterdam are protected. They are, it's definitely not the first choice that anyone would probably make as a career or as a job. But at least they are not subject to crime as much as the women I see in Italy, where it's kind of tolerated, but it's not exactly legal. And it's kind of agonizing to see, young women who are clearly kind of imprisoned and forced into this work. Whereas in Amsterdam, it's legal, they're protected, they have rights, they have insurance, they have health care. It's a whole different thing, and it's much better for them. So I think, we're not going to eliminate it by keeping it illegal. Certainly.
Illegal. Mm-hmm.
So I firmly believe that it should be legalized. And then we should try to figure out how to, I don't know, how to address a huge problem of human nature.
Yeah, well, let's talk about this book. How long did it take you to write it? It's very detailed. You have a lot of great quotes in the beginning of different chapters. You yourself are quoting, the different characters are quoting different authors throughout. How long did it take you to write the book?
Time, actually. It started out as short stories. I was, I'll just say this, but I didn't really want to write this book. I didn't feel that I was the right person to be writing it. I thought I didn't have, it wasn't appropriate for me, an outsider, to kind of come in and start writing, deeply about this country that is really not my country. Italy is my adopted country, so I think I kind of, but Madagascar is a country that I have had an ongoing encounter with, and it still goes on, but basically as a vacationer, not as a tourist exactly, because I know a lot about it. But I still felt that it was not appropriate, but I just kept on collecting anecdotes, meeting people, and the book, as books do, insisted kind of on writing itself. So it took about 10 years to write, I would say, starting in about 2010, when I began to write down stories. I began to make amalgams of people, mixing together people and events. And then I published a couple of stories in the New Yorker. I thought, okay, I will put it together as a collection of stories that will be kind of musings on colonialism, on post-colonialism, on race, and, you know, whatever that I'm seeing in this country during my visits. And then the book just began to be, to hold together. I began to think that Shay, who's kind of me but also kind of not me, should be a character who holds it together along with the idea of the big house.
Yes.
And I began to think it should be a unified story made up of stories. So I began
now
to do
tell
a
us,
research.
Tell
I,
us, yes, the research,
mm-hmm,
cause we talked about that. The research that you were doing
was
very extensive, not just going there. Tell the audience about the different things you were reading and researching.
Because I decided that since if I was going to be writing about it, I had to be, out of respect to this country, I had to be accurate, you know, not just kind of casually come down and, you know, talk about the wind in the palm trees or whatever, you know. I had to be accurate. So I began reading histories of Madagascar, missionaries' records from the 1800s. Madagascar used to be a French colony, so there are lots of texts and naturalist texts. And then I would begin to read about slavery, slavers' records that were actually written and translated from the Dutch and the Norwegian. And I began to read Malagasy literature because there's a rich amount of Malagasy poetry and prose. It's a very literary-minded country, one of the most so in of all the countries in Africa. I read letters from Paul Gauguin, who decided that he wanted to live in Madagascar before Polynesia. I read about Hitler's Madagascar plan because he had a plan in the 30s to send Jewish people to Madagascar. And everyone seemed to want to use that country, use that island as something, use it, make use of it, exploit it. And so I began to explore all of this, and I didn't want it to be a history book, but I wanted to include it in my stories, if possible. So it took a lot. It took a lot of time, but I wanted also to make it an entertaining book as well. So
now, when you're reading, I read that you normally read in English. Why is that? Because you speak many languages, but you normally read in English. Why is that?
I think it's important for writers to, well, I don't know, you know, this is just me, but I know that if I were to start reading avidly in Italian and French, because I could do that, I would begin to be clumsy in my English. And, you know, when you live outside of your country, you get into this habit of kind of thinking a little bit in the country where you are, thinking a little bit, like in my house, with my kids, we will chit-chat and just throw in an Italian word, baby. And it makes you hesitate when you're writing. Like, the right word doesn't come to mind. Have to, it's like a tool. When you're writing, your English is your unique, wonderful tool, the English language. And so you have to kind of keep it polished up. And I find if I read too much in another language, I will become too involved with that language. I will absorb it too much, and then my English will suffer. So I try not to read. I try to read things that are well translated. If I have to read something in another language, I will. But in French or Italian, I will. But I try to constantly read in English, because otherwise, I think it would make me clumsy in my writing.
There's a lot of magic going on in this book, and one of the powers of the women is possibly their magic. But I love the chapter where the two friends, Shay and her friend, I'm forgetting the name at the moment, but they go to see the tree.
13.
The other friend.
Okay.
She goes to see the tree, and then there's the woman who's disfigured, and her husband is like in the story. The two characters are entranced by the guy, Franco, but me as the reader, I myself was like, do I want to continue to listen to what he has to say, or do I not? Because this is sounding like really crazy, the story this guy's going. So do you dream up and wake up and say, oh, that's a great idea? In your dreams, does stuff come to you
They kind of do, yeah, very often sometimes. You know, I think toys have something to say about that. Yeah, things come to me in my dreams. Things come to me when I'm driving around or walking in the woods or walking in the city. I think, oh, that would be a perfect thing to stick together with another anecdote that I might have, you know, stuck in the back of, you know, in the back of my mind. That would make a really good story. Because a lot of, you know, people think that writers just kind of observe their life and then write that down. But as a matter of fact, it's more of a pastiche. You take things, you put them together. I might have things in the back of my mind for the longest time. Like right now, for example, I'm writing this memoir I told you about, Yaden, and it occurred to me, I remembered a conversation I had with my mother in the kitchen when I was really little, asking why I could not go down. We could not go on a holiday down to plantations in Mississippi. And my mother had to sit down and tell me this whole story. I was like, can we get down there? It would be so cute. Cool. I was very little. And but then I realized that, wait, that kind of connects to the whole idea of this community where we were, which was trying to protect us from, you know, from such knowledge. And maybe we were overprotected, but I had never thought of it. So it linked to another anecdote, which actually didn't happen then, but I realized it would be a perfect fit to this conversation with my mother. So that's kind of going to be part of a chapter. So you're all like, can we go on vacation to Mississippi? She said, no.
I know, right? What?
I'll never forget the look on her face. She was like, cookies, and then she actually turned off the gas. She was like looking like, did I not teach this child anything? She was so shocked. Anyway, but that's how you put a book together. At least that's how I do it, with different pieces that might come from different parts of your life.
Now, who are some of your favorite writers? Like, who do you read? Is there a book that you constantly read over and over again, maybe throughout the years that you've picked up?
Oh, let's see. There's so many. I would say, you know, I love this one book. You're talking about magic. I love Zora Neale Hurston in general, but this book, her book about, it's a memoir about Haiti called Tell My Horse. It's about voodoo, and it is just magnificently written. It's intriguing. Mm. It's mysterious. And I read it over and over again. It's called Tell My Horse. And it's not one of her, you know, one of her usually praised books, but I just love it. And then I'm in love with Master and Margarita by Bulgakov, which is this fantastic Russian novel that combines fantasy and real life, my favorite thing. And there's so many. I mean, I'm kind of in love with Gish Jens, The Resisters, and I just talked about a book that I'm in love with. I just read Dear Miss Metropolitan by Carolyn Farrell, which is an astonishing book. The same thing, mixtures of fantasy and, you know, and extraordinary reality. So I guess, yeah, I mean, so many other books. The Lampedusa's The Leopard, John Toomer's Cain. There's so many books I love that I can't tell you. And that's part of my keeping my English going, reading and rereading these books.
Now, what is going on with this Lord of the Rings skits happening at the funeral thing? Can you tell the audience about that, though? What's going on with that?
Wait,
I do my research now. You can't come on here.
You're kidding me. This is
yes.
I feel like, what, are you spying on my, did my children come and tell you?
I'm not, look.
Lord of the Rings, I knew they were going to laugh. Okay, I'm obsessed with Lord of the Rings. That's true. Okay, so that's one of the books I constantly reread. But because I've been teased about it so much by my son and my daughter, I wasn't going to mention it. However, it's true. I'm a Lord of the Rings nerd, and I constantly
Who's your favorite character in the Lord of the Rings?
I don't know. I guess Frodo, Gandalf. I guess Gandalf might be. He's, you know, it changes through the years because I've been obsessed with it since I was about 12. So now I'm kind of more interested in Gandalf.
I'm a nerd too.
That's
I love the Lord of the Rings.
How did you find this out?
I do my research, Andrea. Oh. Come on now. Let me ask you this. Do you like ice cream sodas still? Because you used to drink ice cream sodas when you were a little girl. What's your favorite food now in Italy?
Well, I do really like ice cream, as a matter of fact. Yes.
Gelato?
My favorite food now. Gelato is one of my very favorite foods, I got to say. I like any kind of pasta. Right now we're having pasta made with pesto that's like from that basil that grew in our backyard. So that's so good. Everything is good here. You're going to have to come back and visit me, and I'll give you some delicious Torino food. But
I can tell the audience that. Yes, ice cream sodas are great.
Tell
what about from Philadelphia? Because you're from Philadelphia. We have cheesesteak. We have water ice, pretzels, anything.
I was talking to my son about this today. Because, you know, my son, all right, so he was born here, went to school in Swarthmore, where I'm going to be teaching. For some reason this morning, I said, Charlie, did you ever eat water ice when you were at Swarthmore? He said, oh, no, of course I did. He said, of course I did. Then we started talking about, like, and which I love, and cheesesteaks, water ice. Grandmother's cooking was like good old, you know, old Southern Black cooking. So I associate Philadelphia with that. My father was a minister, so, you know, we had these delicious Sunday dinners. And so I associate that food with Philadelphia and with home. But to Philadelphia cooking, I would say cheesesteak is what I run to whenever I'm there. So,
what do you put on your cheesesteak? And is it chicken cheesesteak or is it like beef cheesesteak? Like, what's the deal?
Oh, beef cheesesteak. Classic beef steak.
And what kind of cheese and condiments do you do?
Oh, my God. I don't know, to tell you the truth. But I'll tell you, the condiments are generally hot peppers chopped up because I really like them hot. So definitely beef. Yeah, definitely. And I can't wait to do it. I'm coming back in August, and that'll be the first thing I'll do.
I was about to say. Yes. Well, thank you so much, Andrea. This has been such a pleasure talking with you. I'm going to give away a copy of your book. Where can people follow you on social media? Can you let them know?
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram and on Facebook. Instagram, I'm Andrea Gordon Lee. Facebook, I'm Andrea Lee. And on Twitter, it's Andrea Lee. I think it's Andrea Lee. You know, something like, I don't pay much attention to my. And then I have a website, so they can find me there. I can even send it to you. But
yes.
I just want to say I'm thrilled to be coming back to Philadelphia for a year. I can't wait. So.
Oh my gosh, that's going to be amazing.
It's a real treat.
Well,
I
hope you have a great weekend, and thank you so much again for coming on and sharing. I'm going to give away some copies of the book, so. I want to encourage people to follow me on Twitter at Joy Keith. Also check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keith, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keith. Andrea, maybe we'll have lunch or something when you come to Philadelphia. Please stay in touch.
I would love that. Let's do it. Absolutely. Okay, and I'm going to be listening to your next show on swimming pools, because the Nile Swim Club is my go-to place. So I'm going to revive my membership when I get there.
Okay. All right.
Well, summer. Okay. All right.
You have a great weekend.
Thank
okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
You
bye
too.
Bye.
And I'll see you soon. Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Ciao. Thank you, everybody. Stay tuned. I'm going to have another show with singer Lynn Sidmont coming on soon. You don't want to miss it. She has an awesome, fantabulous voice. So please stay tuned for that. Talk to you soon. Have a great weekend.
Every year, millions of Americans are exposed to a contagious virus.
What is this virus? It's stigma.
Stigma promotes an environment of shame,
fear, and silence,
which prevents millions of people from seeking help.
But there's good news.
The National Alliance on Mental Illness believes stigma towards mental illness is 100% curable.
So do yourself and everyone a favor.
Go to curestigma.org and get tested for stigma.